Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm HRN's executive director, Katie Mosman Wadler, with a preview of the latest episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We're counting down the days to the 4th of July, so this week's theme is independence. After all, we're an independent food radio station.
HRN is a labor of love. Staff, hosts, and listeners all share the belief that storytelling can change the world, one bite or sound bite at a time.
We take a moment to ponder our founding mothers and fathers, specifically what they were drinking during the Revolutionary War.
Rum in various combinations with beer and cider would be the order of the day.
We highlight a story of self-sufficiency on the island of Vieques, Puerto Rico.
The biggest thing we did was to start a lot of fermented vegetables because we knew the first thing to go would be refrigerator trucks coming to the island.
And we examine the challenges facing independent grocery stores across the U.S.
The struggle is real, but the future looks bright.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, available at heritageradionetwork.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcast live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every daily in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Christina Lecky, who is the executive chef at Reynard in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Before joining Reynard, Christina worked for some of the best chefs in the United States, including Alfred Portale and April Bloomfield. And Christina's chef's idea of becoming a chef originated in her experience in Japan while she was at high school. So today we'll discuss how Japan inspired her career and her unique cooking style and her sustainable efforts at Reynard that shares the essence of Japanese mottainai philosophy and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And I have a couple of announcements. So first, I'll be moderating a fun discussion about miso at MOFAT, the Museum of Food and Drink in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, on Thursday, July 12th from 6:30 to 8:30. And the title of the event is The Multitude of Miso, An Evening with Besso. And Maiko Kyogoku, who joined me on episode 78, and her executive chef, Emily Yuen of Besso, a charming Japanese restaurant in NoHo, will discuss the beauty of the Japanese superfood, miso, how it's made, how they use it at home and at their restaurant. And the event includes a cooking demonstration and tasting. Tickets are available at themofad.org/events. That is MOFAD.org/events. And finally, the 22nd Sumo Stew is coming to New York on Tuesday, July 17th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Arrogant Swine in Brooklyn. And as you may know, Sumo Stew is a seasonal live streaming event of sumo matches straight from Japan. And you can enjoy Japanese food from outstanding restaurants as well as you watch the matches. And it's going to be the biggest Sumo Stew ever. And the venue is outdoor for the summery weather. And this round of Sumo Stew will feature a North Carolina barbecue-style whole hog chanko nabe or chanko hot pot in collaboration with Tyson Ho of Arrogant Swine. And the tickets are available at sumostew.com. That is SUMOSTEW.com, sumostew.com. And for Japanese listeners, there is a $10 off discount code. That is Japan Eats. And just one word, Japan Eats. So please enjoy. Now let's start a conversation with Christina Lecky. Hello, Christina.
Welcome. Hi.
So first, let's talk about your background. So where did you grow up and what did you eat when you grew up?
I grew up in Philadelphia. My grandparents both came from Italy. So in a very Italian-centric family and upbringing. My grandparents were very fond of gardening. My mother, even in her row home in Philadelphia, had a garden in the backyard. So during the summer, lots of fresh vegetables. In the winter, fall, some preserved canned vegetables. Lots of fresh foods and pasta.
Wow, that sounds like the best. You said it was the best situation.
Yeah, it was pretty nice. You know, I feel like my parents were working very hard, and they had myself and two other kids to feed. So sometimes our weekday dinners would be a little rushed, but always taking time on the weekends for a longer, more extended meal.
Wow. So sounds like you had a good foundation.
A pretty good foundation, yeah.
And I heard that you went to Japan during your senior year in high school. So how did it happen?
I went to like a kind of a trade high school where I learned communications. And while I was there, my communications teacher was very interested in Japanese culture. We had done in our high school an exchange of Japanese students coming in many times. And, you know, he sort of got the idea, well, if they're coming here, it might be nice to send some kids from the city to go to Tokyo and Omiya, Japan, just to learn the culture, see the schools and how the kids there are taught. We mostly did observations while we were there in class. We learned like some basic calligraphy and just some like simple like paper folding and, you know, just some like ritualistic Japanese culture. So I basically begged my parents to let me go on this trip because I thought it was very important for me to see the world and kind of an easy way to do it. And I sort of liked how extreme it was because it was so far away. And that was very exciting for me. And yeah, so I got accepted to go. And yeah, and it sort of just, you know, it fell into place for me there.
So it sounds like it's a small group of students.
Yeah, it was like 12 of us.
Yeah. And then how many months? How long
was
it?
1 month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So that's very intense.
Yeah.
Okay. So you stay with your host family?
Yeah, I stayed with a principal and his wife and her parents in a pretty, I think, typical house. Just in the center of Omiya. And
Omiya is it's a Saitama prefecture, so fairly close, like commuting distance from central Tokyo.
Yeah, we would take the train every morning really early and sort of like get our day going at like 6 a.m. And for me, I just remember the sense of community within the family and how just how like everybody worked together and everybody sort of respected everybody's role within the family. And how important meals were, no matter if it was 5 a.m. because we were getting up before school or work, or at dinner time. There was a lot of attention and time. And there was a slowness that I feel like sometimes, at least my American household growing up, felt very frenetic and kind of chaotic. There was a lot of control and attention to detail and time spent in a way that I was not used to.
Right. So there's no drive-through, like not in the car.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it sounds like you got lucky to experience that kind of a fairly traditional household experience. Right. Okay. And so what did you eat in Japan?
I mean, I tried everything for the first time because growing up in Philadelphia, the thing that I wasn't exposed to was I probably had never eaten Japanese food before in my life. I mean, I knew Japan and I understood, but I didn't ever taste those kind of foods growing up until I'd gone. So, I mean, a typical meal in the morning would be some braised shredded beef, some pickled vegetables, a little broth. And, you know, I feel like I was like slow to start to enjoy to eat it, but I really did like it. It was just I was not used to being up at like, you know, I think time change and being up at 5 a.m. So sometimes I wouldn't fully finish all my food and they would be very concerned that I was not happy with what I was eating. But inside of my brain, I knew I was just like so blown away. And then at night we would have, you know, again, some sort of broth or flavorful soup. There would be times one evening it was all like different seafoods. They wanted to show us all the local amazing fish and shellfish that were from Japan that they all prepared in a very lovely way. Some was fried, some was grilled. You know, I taste it. We went to a very proper omakase sushi meal when I was there. We had, you know, tonkatsu and, you know, I think all the different levels of between home-style Japanese cooking and also very refined like sushi culture.
Wow. Well, you're always an adventurous eater.
I didn't want to turn anything down when I was there. I felt so open and I just felt like as a child, like I watched myself grow so much and my open and willingness to explore was just so memorable to me that I still think about it today. And, you know, I often attribute Japan to teaching me about a palate and understanding flavors and learning how the subtleties of the ingredients or the flavors. I remember the night I arrived, we drank a little bit of green tea and I was just like, you know, it just tastes kind of like hot water. Like I didn't really get the subtleties of, and then the more I drank it and the more I thought about why it was so revered and why they were so special and understanding the story and how it's made and the temperatures that it had to be prepared. And I think then I just started like understanding and my palate would open to the small nuances.
Interesting. Because green tea is almost like the most subtle taste.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow. Which I was like, okay. By the end, I was like, oh, I get it and I like it and I can taste the little nuances and I felt really excited about that. And I tasted like jellyfish, I'm sure, for the first time. I'm sure like there were so many squishy, like texturally foods that I've eaten, especially in desserts that I never would have experienced just staying in the United States at that time. And it was really special and it was very humbling. And just the openness of the Japanese people, and there was just such compassion and care for detail and just so much pride in what everybody was showing me, what they were learning and doing.
But I'm curious, so you didn't speak Japanese that time, right?
No,
so
I mean, we learned like basic phrases to get by and we would always have a translator.
But at home, how did you communicate with that?
Luckily, because the host father was a principal, he spoke very good English and he would interpret for his wife and for the grandparents.
So that's how you learned the straight into depths of Japanese culture.
Just asking him a lot of questions. He was very patient.
And I think that's what he wanted. I'm so curious. Right. So, and I heard that your experience in Japan kind of paved the way for your career as a chef. So what exactly inspired you to, you know, your kind of career perspective? How did it happen?
Yeah, I think for me, you know, growing up around my grandparents who were very much interested in cooking with a lot of detail and a lot of care, and my mom sort of did that as well. And then going to Japan and again, just like watching, like understanding that I loved food because I was there and I was enjoying it. And I was, you know, it was at such a fussy time for a kid where they could easily not like things. And a lot of people that went didn't enjoy the food that they were eating or missed home. And I sort of fell in love with the adventure and sort of fell in love with the flavors. And I think for me, it just, I just sort of love the care and detail, you know, that my grandparents put into the food that that I'd witnessed in Japan. And I just sort of fell in love with the idea of potentially doing that for a living. And, you know, it was long enough ago that it wasn't like the most posh or excited idea. You know, a lot of people, especially women, I think at the time were not really cooking, or you didn't really know about many of them cooking. And so I kind of was scared, you know. In high school, it's so hard to know what you're going to want to do for the rest of your life. So I kept applying for jobs for colleges and finally decided to go to a college in Philadelphia for fashion apparel management and fashion design. And
yeah. But let me stay with that a little bit more longer about, you know, inspiration from Japan, because I think, you know, like you grew up in Italian household. I think, as far as I understand, Italian palate and mindset about ingredients and nature and seasonality, very similar to Japanese, right? And you didn't think of becoming a chef before the trip to Japan.
No.
So what's the difference?
I just think for me, the love and the attention of the people with the food and the ingredients was the thing that I sort of, like, I just saw how happy it made them to prepare food for people, or how much love and effort was going into it. And it just sort of like stuck with something for me that I would like to do. And also, like, I just enjoyed eating so much, and I enjoyed just like tasting new things so much. Like, that was so important to me. And I just, like, when I got back, I sort of was like, what else can I try? Where else can I go eat? Like, what, you know, there was definitely a much more like worldly focus on like growing my palate and exploring as much as possible that definitely wasn't there before, before I went on that trip.
Right. Okay. So do you find any favorite food? If when you came back, you wanted to eat that again?
I mean, I definitely just eating rice in general and broths, I think, became something that I was like often trying to seek out, like things flavored with miso were very, I just love the richness of it and the way it made me feel when I'd eat it. You know, eating tempura for the first time, as silly as that is, of course, like, who doesn't love something like perfectly, the most delicately fried, which is very hard to find. And I don't think I found that again, in, you know, for many, many years, because it's an art to do it so perfectly.
Right. Somebody spends their whole life.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's sort of what, like, yeah, that's what inspires me so much about Japanese food culture, because there is somebody who is like literally perfecting the art of tempura. I find that so fascinating and so, I don't know, humbling and endearing, and just how long it takes to perfect a craft. Like, it keeps me dry, it keeps me with a drive that know that I, even though I feel like I'm a certain age, I still have a lot more to learn and grow and and explore and do better.
That's interesting you said, because I think that reminds me, what you said just reminded me of, you know, the way of like judo, kendo, like do means the way of the spiritual ultimate form of whatever you do. So maybe that's the professional idea about cooking. And it's almost, food is a tool to pursue your perfection as a human being.
Yeah.
Right? So,
yeah, it's so beautiful.
That's why I'm not the chef. But you are. So anyway, so so you are talking about you went to study fashion and then you decided to become chef eventually. So what made you to make that decision?
Well, I was always working during my time in college, I was always working in restaurants as a server, as a busser, hostess. Eventually sort of found myself in the kitchen doing expediting the services around the chefs and just seeing the energy that they had and sort of the fun that they were having while they were cooking. I was just sort of drawn to that energy, and I just started to think about that a lot more than thinking about what my career would look like after I'd leave college and go into some sort of role in fashion. And it just became more apparent that I was just much more interested in that. So I decided, you know, pretty quickly to just, because I was very nervous about like wasting any time, just immediately start, you know, I left and went into culinary school and then immediately started cooking while I was in school and almost was learning so much while I was going to school all day and then going to work. I mean, the hours were very, very long that I just decided that I should just be in the kitchen as much as possible. So then when I left culinary school, I decided if I'm going to not be in school anymore, I needed to work in a very strict, very like intense kitchen to learn all of the things that potentially leaving school I might be missing. And that's sort of how I found myself at the Striped Bass.
Okay. So the Striped Bass was in Philadelphia by Alfred Portale.
Yeah.
Who is, of course, the chef owner of the Gotham Barn Grill, which is iconic
New York. Yeah. Right. And he definitely took a chance on me. I mean, he personally interviewed me and I was just such a kid. I didn't really know much and, you know, but he saw something in me and took a chance and, you know, and it took me a really long time to find my footing in that restaurant. It was really funny because my friend, I saw him in the hallway. We went to high school together. He was a sous chef at the restaurant.
Oh, wow.
And it was like a really happy coincidence. And it made me feel like, okay, he's here. Like, I might have a friend here. I might be able to make it. But they taught me so much about just discipline and perfection and, you know, crazy sourcing for the most somewhat exotic, best ingredients. You know, it was definitely at a time where we would be getting fish from all over the world and nobody was questioning that sort of ethos, you know. But, you know, you'd be receiving the best of the best from everywhere. And so I got to see a lot of things and taste a lot of things and, yeah, just worked with a really tough but, you know, amazing group of people.
Yeah, as far as I learned about you, you very intuitively capture what you want to do and you act on it and you really, you know, grab the moment and you keep going so strong. So
thank you.
It's very inspiring. Yeah, so then you you worked at the Striped Bass and then you worked with Christopher Lee at the Guild in New York.
I met him at Striped Bass and, you know, I was just like a tour knot. Like I was just starting to get my groove there. And he had been given an opportunity to take over the restaurant in New York. And he had asked me to come along. And I was like, how could I say no to this? I wasn't even a sous chef. He was taking some sous chefs. And he had said yes. He had asked me. And I mean, I would have been crazy not to do it. So I said yes. And, you know, eventually became a sous chef there. And again, another really, you know, and being in a new city, again, being able to hone skills and work on really niche dishes for a small tasting menu, lots of trial and error and repetition. And, you know, it was very, very interesting to work in that way. I mean, the Striped Bass was kind of like that, but it was a much bigger restaurant. This was like a very specific tasting menu only. Really fine dining, using the best ingredients. Reminds me of what I loved about Gil was we had such a large tea program there. There was like maybe like 200 different types of tea. And that always reminded me of my time when I was in Japan because I loved tea there. That's when I learned about all the, you know, nuanced small flavor, but labor teas. And yeah, we had such a big tea. Every day I would have like a very special before service, a very special tea done at the proper temperature. It was like a very nice, like calming moment before.
Is that by Chris Day?
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, totally.
He's at the 11 Madison now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got that show of his passion about tea.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Even I think that was the biggest, even now, including now.
Yeah.
Experience. I mean, the program about tea. So, okay, and then you worked after that. You worked for April Bloomfield. Everybody reviews her. So yeah. At the Breastlane. So how did it happen?
I met April at an event when I was working at Gill. It's funny how everything sort of transitions into something else. And I used to always go eat at the Spotted Pig like a couple times a month with friends after work. because we were working in Midtown and we would close it much earlier than, you know, the place in the West Village that would be open very late. And I would go there and actually like eat vegetables because I think one, I needed nourishment, and two, like I just was never interested in eating like hamburgers or like heavy fatty foods. So I would lean towards the vegetables there. And I sort of was, because the dishes that we were doing at Gilt were so labor intensive and so like 50 components and so like intricate in a very different way, that I think I was so taken aback by how a 3-ingredient salad could be so flavorful and so perfect and like not wanting more, you know, not garnishing for the sake of garnishing or having every texture available on a plate, but it was still like so satisfying. And that always stuck with me. And so I eventually met her and she was hiring and I was offered a sous chef job, and I sort of just worked my way up to be the executive chef at Breslin by the time that my role was over there.
Right. So so all those three super successful restaurants, what did you learn at each place with each chef?
I mean, I think, you know, at starting out, I think I learned foundation and classic French techniques from my first experience. And I think Gilt, I learned more about like honing in and creative aspects of creating menus, creating dishes, and precision, and again, more exposure to ingredients. And I think with April, I learned to strive for like consistency and perfection and simplicity. Like just because the food is simple doesn't mean there's not, you know, you never serve a old herb or a brown leaf, like always looking at the really small details. And then, you know, teaching myself how to manage a much larger team and a much busier, more fast-paced environment.
Right. Because Breslin is really busy too.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's like breakfast. It was breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And
because it's a nice hotel.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So so let's take a quick break here, and then when we come back, we'll talk about how Christina practices Japanese philosophy of Mottainai at Raynard. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hey, this is Michael Harlan Turkel from the Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I've been with the station for over 8 years, 350 shows, and it is the most consistent thing in my life. Every Tuesday at 3, I know to be here in studio, but I also get the privilege of meeting such amazing people, artists, artisans within the industry. Get to learn a new factoid, a new way of life from these wonderful people. And I hope you do too by listening, and that you donate to our summer drive. Just go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and click on the beating heart. And we'd even appreciate monthly recurring donations to any show on the network you could designate to the Food Scene, the Speakeasy, and that many more.
Well, Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from our studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Aki Kotema, and my guest today is Christine Araki, who is executive chef at Reynard in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. By the way, Reynard definitely is one of my favorite restaurants in the whole city. So now let's talk about Reynard. So you joined Reynard in September 2017 as the executive chef. So how did it happen?
I actually started in July.
Okay.
That's okay. But it happened because I was a regular at Andrew Tarlow's restaurants, and he happened to catch wind that I was not working and I was taking a break. And
let's talk about Andrew quickly. So yeah. How do you describe him? He's my hero too.
Yeah, he's a really, I mean, you know, I think Andrew is just, I don't know why I always lean towards the word gentle, but I do think he's just such a gentle, kind human who's very thoughtful about the things that he does, and has a really beautiful way of expressing that amongst his restaurants, and just a care for his employees and, you know, for the people that is in his life. And I think, you know, I'm drawn to that because, you know, it's not too often that you get to work with people who are really people focused and really thinking about, you know, the well-being of their staff and how that affects him and his businesses.
Mm. Yeah, he started his first restaurant Diner.
Mm-hmm.
How many years ago? Like 15, 20 years ago.
It's going to be 20 this year. Yeah.
Right. And he's. I think he really doesn't show that this is my empire. Or anything.
Yeah, it's not an empire. It's more. Yeah, it's like a community.
Right. So sounds like employees are happy. They don't quit, or they just move around different.
I feel like eventually people do leave, but I think that when people leave, they've definitely put in a lot more time than some people might put in other places.
And graduate into some
totally
something their own
for
things.
Sure.
Right. So all right. So the Reynard is within the White Hotel, which is such a cool Brooklyn style restaurant.
Yeah.
It's definitely
unique, I think, in its way. And yeah, I've been really enjoying myself, and I feel like I've learned a lot, and again, still so much more to learn and do. And
right. So this is a new American restaurant, and then
sure.
Well, since it opened, it's been always using wood fire, but we will talk about your style of cooking with woods soon, in a minute. But what's your philosophy of cooking? Look, after those three amazing chefs we just discussed, so right now, how do you, what kind of style of food would you like to cook for your customers?
I think that type of food that I'm trying to always convey, and again, it's going to take me years to sort of perfect, but right now, it's very portion controlled in a lot of ways. Like, making sure it's the right amount of food on the plate so people don't get oversaturated or feel too stuffed. There's a level of mindful and healthfulness. Obviously, right now I'm working very, very hard about sourcing, and what's great about, like, I feel much happier now than maybe in the winter because there's so many vegetables and amazing farmers to work with right now, and I actually can be very selective about who I can work, whose vegetables I can purchase, and that's like really important to me. So right now I'm like aggressively working on sourcing the best ingredients but also working with farmers who, you know, are giving back to the land and respecting the earth, not just, you know, not just big co-ops and collaborative farms that maybe it's the food is, their vegetables are delicious, but maybe they're not practicing the things that are more, that are giving back to the greater, world, you know?
Right.
So that's been really interesting this summer, and having some, getting a hold of some really small, really beautiful farmers doing some really, really amazing stuff in a small scale kind of way.
Right. So it's totally your idea and Andrew Tarlow's idea of restaurant or providing food to the public sounds like very probably almost exactly the same, because
yeah.
Andrew has the Malouan daughters.
Mm-hmm.
That means there's a butcher shop.
Sure.
For sustainable, responsible supply of meat.
Yeah.
The supply is Reynard too, right?
Sure.
So Yeah, and I think Andrew's wife, Katie, she's from a farm, so she can, she has a real idea of ideal farming too. So that's awesome. So the your menu seems to be really, you know, an Italian in a way, because very clean and a lot of seasonal ingredients, like you just said. So, and I see some Japanese ideas, like you have some tofu or dashi.
Yeah.
So what's your idea of using Japanese?
I like it because there is a healthfulness and a cleanness. And I think what I enjoy about, because the restaurant doesn't have, like, it doesn't have to be like, it's not a Middle Eastern or a definitively Italian. It's sort of New American that I think what we, as we know, America is sort of made up of everything. So I feel like, I feel more relaxed about using certain Japanese ingredients or like producing tofu or making dashi. You know, it's great for me with when we're making a dashi because it's such a good, you know, a utilization of product. You know, we smoke the fish bones in the hearth to add sort of our take on a dashi. So we're not just like, you know, buying the, you know, ingredients outsourced. We're sort of making the ingredients from in-house and trying to mimic something that would be similar to a dashi, so certainly still using like kombu and umami like flavors, but yeah, also taking our scraps and turning that into sort of like a broth sort of based on that.
Right. I think that's a basic idea of dashi is that what exactly it is to create by layering different flavors without wasting anything.
Yeah.
And you create umami. And umami multiplies, not just that up. So it kind of like reduces the amount of salt or other ingredients.
Sure.
So it's really helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to work on more like subtlety of flavors, not just like killing everything with like salt and acid, but making sure things are bright and satiating, you know. It's been sort of like that's the challenge that I'm at right now.
But after the last meal provided by you, I usually, you know, you'd go out and then before you go to bed, it's like, oh my God, why did I eat so much?
Yeah.
And I didn't have that feeling at all. So
yeah, and that's what I'm sort of striving to. I know I had some friends in recently and, you know, they were like, we don't really want to eat meat. Is that going to be, is that hard? And I'm like, no, you know, like there's so many great vegetables to try right now. And I do think that's what's so great about it. Like you can really, you can like certainly eat a piece of steak, but I also think the piece of steak you're going to eat is, yes, it's properly sourced and it's nicely aged and it's all, but it's also a good portion size. You know, you're not going to, you know, if there is a large steak on the menu, it's meant to be shared, you know,
I
mean, and we certainly encourage that, you know, and I just feel like it feels like the right fit and amount of protein to eat mixed with some really fresh vegetable to go along with it to sort of help that. And yeah, and that's sort of like how I think about like when I'm portioning stuff, you know.
Well, it's just really, I think less is more, right? Like you appreciate the taste. And can you imagine like one sushi could be like five times bigger?
It's crazy. No, it's true.
Right. Okay. So, so let's talk about your cooking with wood. So your menu is almost entirely cooked over wood fire, not gas, right?
Yeah.
So what's special about cooking with wood?
What's special is it builds flavor. It adds another element. I think that is sort of my main attraction to it. I think as a cook, as a chef, it's more work to do. So you're constantly touching the ingredients or moving the fire around or building it. And it, you know, and it's often just like every day sort of a work in progress and a learning. But I think it also gives you a lot of freedom to do lots of different cooking techniques at once, you know, like for example, if we have like a broccolini on the menu right now and we blanch it and then we like hang it in the hearth to pick up some smoke and then we finish it, you know, on the grill or on the plancha near the fire. And, you know, it's just like, I just feel like there's so much complexity within, you know, and you have so much more freedom. It just keeps things so much more fresh and interesting than just like turning on a gas burner and putting something in a pan and just like then turning the burner off and then like, you know, like, I mean, certainly there's there's ways of building. Right. It's just a different way of building flavor for me with the wood that I really enjoy.
Mm. So wood cooking, to me, it's like you are kind of like a lifetime of wood, right? Like a fresh wood, cut wood, and then you make it into charcoal. So you have different style of heat source. Mm-hmm. Because you're cooking wood, too, as you cook ingredients.
Yeah, you're basically cooking the wood to get the charcoal to then,
busy.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Right. And you have a very interesting equipment, which I saw in your kitchen. So you have plancha,
like a flat heat surface.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then smoker and wood rack so that you can...
Yeah, you're hanging things.
The smoke.
Yep.
And then you have a hearth.
And then, the hearth and then the grill.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Do you have differentiate, the young wood, mm-hmm. the fresh flame? And how do you use the flame versus...
So the flame, it's very easy. Like, we can put a log and just put that directly underneath the plancha.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's more of almost turning on a burner.
Mm.
Because you're not directly... you're using the wood as... basically how gas, would heat up a pan. So that's where we can put some bigger logs and maybe ones that aren't the most cured are going to give us the best results. And then we load up in a basket, just a bunch of logs, basically so the coals will fall down. And those we can cook directly on, which I really have been enjoying is putting things in maybe a little mesh basket and just sort of giving it a quick saute in the morning. I just think this is I get so the thought that somebody could come in to the restaurant and have homemade yogurt with strawberries that have just been lightly roasted in the coals. I think it's just what is such a unique, special experience that where in New York can you have a breakfast like that? I just think, and it's also I think so that kind of stuff, and at dinner we do a lot of vegetable cookery in the directly in the coals, and we cook bread directly directly on the coals, and and we do mostly the meats are grilled and some are roasted in a wood oven, but trying to try to divide the menu evenly around the kitchen, sort of not paying much attention to the saute or there we do have a few burners, but it's not the point of the restaurant, I don't think. So we try not to put a lot of focus there.
Right. The charcoal, the coal is very interesting because, binchotan, that's a binchotan. I think it's brand name, a champagne.
It
has to be from a couple regions, Kishu, Niniwakayama prefecture. And I think the charcoal, there's a high infrared rays, so it penetrates deeper into cooking. So
some of it, it's I feel like you buy it because it doesn't produce a lot of smoke. So in a kitchen that might be kind of small without good ventilation, it's also good. And I feel like the binchotan is also, the coals last longer depending on the level and how high it goes. You can have it, and I've worked with the Japanese grill like that before, and we would always save the coals because you would just cool them and the next day use them to start the fire because why wouldn't you? And also they're so expensive, the specific Japanese ones.
Right. Yeah. I checked the price before.
Yeah, that's crazy. But they do last, I will say for it. There is a value there. They last a very long time. It's not like getting the bagged charcoal that you get.
Right.
That stuff burns in seconds,
Right. So it's maybe a more kind of dense coal?
Dense, yeah. Right, very dense.
So it lasts longer.
Very dense, very hardwood, yeah.
Mm. Right. And when I had your chicken, that was smoked, I think, over the rack.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely impressively smoky but very subtle. So that's the magic of the back.
Totally. And keeping it in a certain area, how much direct contact to the smoke it has, that's sort of what I enjoy about it. I think because we have so many ways to build the nuance flavors, it doesn't have to be so, you don't feel like you're eating barbecue or you're eating smoked foods, so by the end of your meal your palate is sort of so burnt on smoke flavors. Sometimes if you eat real Southern barbecue or, it's so intensely smoky by the end of it, you're whoa,
Right. That's,
but I do. That's what I enjoy about this. The sort of the way that we're trying to do things is that it's gradually building flavor or building smoke, and it being kind of subtle. And maybe it's not like it's not so obvious when you're immediately tasting it. And you're like, oh, I get it. But like, it makes you. Excuse me, like sort of have to think about it a little more.
Yeah, I understand that the barbecue, that's very charred, like, you know, very strong flavor. And you need a hot heat sauce, like a hot sauce. But when I had your chicken, it was my almost amazingly sweet chicken meat. That's
the meat is, again, just from really good sourcing and being very fortunate. I mean, the chicken that we're buying right now, it's like some of the best chicken I've ever had in my life. I think it's just so special and it's so chickeny flavored. Yeah, almost it has like a little bit of sweetness to it.
Right. But I think the smokiness of that, the subtle but strong smokiness made it sweeter. That's like might be the contrast.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I really like that. I have to come back to taste it again. So we've been talking about the mottainai. Mottainai is that you can't waste it. That's the Japanese foundational idea. We are like cheap people. But so I heard that you work very hard to minimize waste from your kitchens. So so first, where is the idea from? Why do you think it's important?
I think, well, it's important because we know the world is, you know, with so many things are becoming so much more apparent on how we're treating our world and the environment. And I think anybody who is getting into any sort of big business is, they're just not coming at it in any of the right way to not even have that in their minds, I think. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's a hard thing to sort of, because the challenges of working in such a large restaurant with so many different services, it's so hard to control. So that's why for me, if I felt like if I didn't like start putting that as a focus first, then it would just never really materialize. So, you know, the way that we try to do it is, you know, for me, it's working with smaller farms and more, everything as literally local as possible, or making everything in-house as possible to cut down on package waste and products. So it's, you know, it's great when we get, you know, when we have our farm deliveries from smaller farms, they just give you stuff in either biodegradable bags or they have it in crates, and then you take the vegetables out of the crate, they take the crates back, and then, you know, we put them in our reusable containers. It just, like, makes a lot more sense. It's, like, so, you know, for me, that's like, a first and foremost sort of thing that I'm trying to eliminate, as much, like, box waste. And, I mean, yeah, the stuff's being recycled, but it's also, like, you know, the shelf life of that box is so small for the amount of energy it takes to make it, and you know, for me, it's just such a waste because we have no use for it.
Right. And for farmers or whoever delivers, it's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money to buy them. I know. And that's sort of, it's interesting, as much as like you think people would just be like, oh yeah, let's not do it that way. I just think like the bigger places get and the bigger, you know, it's just, they feel like that's the best way to ship or to get their products then. And I get that, but I just, then I'm just like, well, maybe you're too big of a company to work with. And I'm trying to only work with people who will do things a little differently and be thinking in a bigger way, you know?
Right. Well, by the way, you know, that's very environmentally friendly. And then at the kitchen level, like, for instance, you know, Japanese people, like, they eat blowfish and they remove the poisonous part. And then, like, even from really little head to tail, the tail one, you roast it.
Yeah.
And put it in the hot sake and drink. Mm-hmm. That's, like, complete whole eating.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I heard you do that, too.
Like, sure.
Pills.
Yeah, we, I mean, you know, for example, the chicken you ate is, the broth is made from the backbones that weren't used. You ate all the offal. There was kidney, heart, and liver, and gizzards.
That's in the sauce, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually really tasty part.
Yeah, I mean, you're eating the whole thing right there. That's a really great example. You know, we take the fish bones and we dry them out and we're adding them to broths for adding some smoke, but also adding a little bit of subtle fishiness to things. Every vegetable scrap, you know, if we try to either dry it in the hearth and make powders or fortify stocks, or, you know, right now it's a big shell season, like pea shells and fava, you know, we're charring and adding to broths, or again, drying things out, or, you know, fermentation is another way that we like try to sort of think less about the compost bin, you know, and think more about putting it back into a dish.
Mm. And it's not just saving what could be waste. You're actually adding flavors because...
Sure.
Yeah, this mutainai idea I heard is kind of came from Buddhism. Mm. And there's a word saying, nokori mono ni hakugaru. There's a god-like luck in the leftover. Mm. That's the idea.
I like that.
Yeah, but it's like appeals. I think people say skin has the best nutrition. Sure. And you make it powder. And you have more flavor, right? And by making the powder, you can use it more flexibly.
Yeah, totally.
So, yeah, it's a creating value rather than saving waste. Mm. So, okay. And so I have, this is something I was so curious about. So you take care of your staff people this is more about your management skills in the kitchen because... Yeah. Sounds like you're doing so well. So how do you take care of your people?
What I remembered from my last experience being like such a high manager was that I felt my staff was afraid to speak to me because, I don't know, there was just for some reason I was just like too high up and they didn't feel like it was an approachable environment that they could turn to me for help. So when I started at Renard, it was very important for me to make sure that, yes, I am your boss. Yes, I'm on a level. But more than that, I'm also here for you and for your wellness and for your health. I think a lot of people, especially in the industry that I've chosen, struggle with issues. You know, maybe they're separated from their families, or they have mental stress or depression, or they're not eating correctly, or they're maybe partying too much. And you know, I try to like really pay attention to what, you know, as much as I can, what my staff is doing, and also just sort of created like an open door policy to come in and talk about anything that might be troubling you. If you need advice, if you need, you know, counseling, if some, you know, especially in terms of like safety within the company, you know, making sure if somebody said something to you that made you uncomfortable, that like your voice matters, this matter, like, just making sure people feel protected and safe, and also that they have a voice and their voice matters, I think has been sort of the thing that I like, we talk about it, you know, I probably have a meeting with my staff, you know, once every couple months, and we always re-bring it up, you know, and, you know, with the recent death of Anthony Bourdain, sort of just sitting down with the staff and saying like, hey, like mental health is a real, you know, is a real issue. And, you know, please just know that like me, my other chefs, we're all here helping each other, working together. But also like, if you are going through something, you need an extra moment, if you're feeling distracted, you know, it's just going to help me, you know, instead of assuming that people are being lazy or being, careless or, you know, despondent at work, you know, it's getting to the bigger issue of why maybe somebody's behavior might be off, instead of resorting to frustration and anger has sort of been my approach with this.
Right. Yeah, that's amazing. And one of my great friends, he manages a call center of suicide hotline.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, people just want to be listened to.
Yeah.
You don't need a solution. You just want them to feel there's somebody there for you. So... Yeah, but it's not easy to do.
It's not easy, no. Yeah, and I mean, again, I would say this is the part of my career, besides, of course, I need to continue to push myself culinarily and make sure that I'm striving still for excellence. But I think more in a human sense, as my, like, as I get older, it's sort of where I want to make sure I'm putting a lot of energy and focus to make sure that I am the best person I can be at work, and making sure that, yeah, people who have decided to make sacrifices in their lives to come work with me are getting something in return, and besides just being paid, you know.
Right. So, nowadays, you know, we are talking about gender issues too. But is that something related to how you can be successful as a female chef, and you can stay focused and strong? Is that?
In what way?
Yeah, like you know, like you listen to your team.
Sure.
And you're kind of building a strong team. Is that the key to manage your kitchen as you focus and try to become the greatest chef as well?
Yeah, no, I definitely think so. I mean, I think, you know, I think I've seen a lot of men run kitchens, and I think I've seen a lot of mistakes that were made. And I think everybody in the industry is sort of trying to learn and focus on being better and being more thoughtful. I think for me, it's just, I don't want to do it anymore if that's not how we're going to be conducting ourselves. And mm-hmm. and I think as a female, I think it's just important to make sure that, you know, I'm identified as being a female leader, but also that I'm a woman trying to take care of my staff as a whole and myself and my sous chefs.
Right. So it's maybe it's becoming a good time for the kitchen, whole kitchen, for female regardless. Yeah, because I think I had a conversation with conservative Japanese culinary industry, and the younger generation, they say, are really changing.
Cause yeah.
You can be, because it's the time of information, yeah. And you cannot pretend that you know everything.
Yeah, and I also think, I applaud the younger generation for, saying no to things, like seeing injustice or, they're not so easily bullied or will be pushed around. And, I think, my generation, I felt like you had no choice. You had to sort of do things that, even though you felt like it was a hardship or a sacrifice or, but you would never say no or you'd never push back. You just sort of blindly went along with what was told of you.
Right.
And I applaud, the younger generation now to be a little more like have some standards earlier on or have some value for themselves.
Mm. Right. So sounds like you're a good communicator. That goes back to high school. Right.
Trying.
Yeah. So are you still in touch with your host family?
Unfortunately not. I'm like, I really should. I am planning on hopefully getting back to Japan in not this fall, but maybe winter or early spring of next year. Mm. So I would like to go and sort of research and see where everybody is at.
Yeah, well, they'll be so proud of you. Yeah. And especially they inspire this great show.
Yeah, I know, it's true.
Right. Okay, so please keep me posted.
I will.
Yeah, so where can we find your updates?
Updates, well, you can on my Instagram, I usually post things, but my email, if anybody has any questions or needs anything, do you want me to give it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. My email is Christina, ch@withehotel.com.
Great. All right. So thank you for joining us today and good luck.
Thank you.
All right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or kikokatema.com. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And our engineer is David Tatashore. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.